Redstaff for you. Six.
On the day when Thor was rested, I didn't know anything of it until it was a Saturday, and he'd made a mistake, an error, which he blamed himself for later on. He was going to meet as representative of the Freedom Council, a group of people connected with underground papers, and they had sort of a meeting once a week. And it was at a certain place, and he went up there, and there was a signal that if there was a newspaper in the door, put into the door handle, then there was free access. If it wasn't there, it would keep away. So he came up and went up the stairs. There was no newspaper. And he thought, oh, they forgot again. They also forgot last time, but apologized. But so to be on the safe side, he went down to a telephone kiosk, rang up the number, and said, it's all. And they said, oh, it's right, you come. But it was Gestapo who answered. And so when he came next time, and of course he shouldn't have done that. It's one of these things which could be fatal and was fatal in his case. But this is something I heard of afterwards, didn't know. But it so happened that on the day when the RAF bombed the shell house, where they had put on the top floor all the most important resistance people, including Professor Thaw, as key persons, so that as to prevent the RAF from bombing the building, because if you do that, you will destroy your own allies. But they did it all the same. On that particular day, Kelly Abel, the playwright, whom I mentioned previously, and I had a meeting. He was underground by this time, because in January, early January 1944, after the Germans had assassinated another Danish playwright, a clergyman, Pastor Kai Munk, and thrown his dead body in a ditch near his vicarage. And he was a well-known playwright who'd written several plays, who'd been performed at the Royal Theatre. And I go back, but it's relevant. He had then decided that after the news got out, and of course it mustn't get out into the papers as anything but Kai Munk died, not murdered or assassinated or not the details. So just a short, brief notice where it would have filled the front page otherwise. But Kelly Abel decided that after this has happened, they were going to perform at the Royal Theatre a farce of some kind. And he said, this mustn't happen. They must have the decency to cancel this performance. So he went to the director of the theatre and implored him to cancel it, and said, I daren't, because there will be reprisals from the Germans if we do. And then he went to one of the actors who played a leading part in this play and said, you have a diplomatic influenza, so you can't perform tonight, and at the last minute, so it's cancelled for that reason. But he didn't dare do that either. So Kelly Apple decided to take his own course. And as a playwright, he had access from the to the stage door of the theatre. At that time, he was a normal person, not underground. And so he, as soon as the play had started, and they'd said their first lines, he went in through the wings, interrupted the play, and said, Denmark's greatest playwright, Kay Munk, has been assassinated. I asked you for 2 minutes silence and stand up. And this happened. And of course, he knew that the consequences of this. So he had arranged to go underground, both he and his wife, immediately after that. And after he'd left the theater, within a quarter of an hour, the Gestapo were there, but he'd vanished. And I had now contact with him frequently. And on the day when the, now we go back again, on the day when the Gestapo, when the RAF bombed the Shellhouse building, which were the headquarters of the Gestapo in Denmark, Kelly Apple and I had arranged a meeting in a building just opposite to the Shellhouse, by sheer coincidence, a flat for which to which he had access and he had the key there. And while we were sitting there and having a meeting about something or other, we heard the bombers come and we heard saw the bombs. And of course, the ceiling came down over us. We were completely white with stuff coming down there. And we rushed into the shelter. And there were already some young women who were, some of them were wounded and crying and hysterical. And one had a wound in her thigh, and we came with a handkerchief to help her. And they spoke of our friends in the Shellhouse. And we thought, of course, like us, they had friends there who'd been, but it turned out very shortly we realized that their friends were Gestapo people. And so Caleb said, they can keep their hot, rotten thighs to themselves. We're not going to help them. So we now, the bombing was over, and we went out from the basement, and there's a little steps up to the pavement, and now we saw the Shellhouse as a sea of flames. And Kelly Apple, who had meanwhile become very great friends with Mogens Fog, gripped my hand firmly, and we stood there. There was nobody else. We stood there, and he made the most beautiful obituary of Mogens Fog and what he had meant to him personally and to Denmark as a whole, because there was no possible way in which he could have survived. We saw that flame, sea of flames there. So it was certain that either he had died immediately or he'd been burned to death. And this was a moving thing, because it was both personal and national, the feeling that what Mogens Fog had meant to him and to Denmark as a whole. And then, after a while, we parted, and I knew his address, his underground address. He lived with some friends, which are not friends, but whom I also knew. And I lived with the a member of the Supreme Court of Denmark, who had put a guest room at my disposal, knowing who I was and what I was doing and so on.
Who was this?
Oh, well, it was, I mean, he There are 12 members of the Supreme Court, and he was a justice called Topsy Jensen. And his son was a friend of mine, and he said, I'll ask my father if you can't stay with him, because he has a great villa there. And he was very keen to be helpful to the resistance, so I came to stay with a member of the Supreme Court for the period I was in Copenhagen. But anyway, then we were sitting at supper, and Kjell Abel rang, and I took the phone, and he said, I just want to tell you that I have greeted you from Ole, and which was most full. So it was unbelievable he was alive. And he said, Ole is expecting you tomorrow to report what's happened while he's been away. So I had a meeting with him. That was in the early spring. I can't remember the date, but it was in 55 when he managed to escape. There was a floor missing, they had to jump down, and he was certain that when he came down to the bottom, there would be Germans who'd take him away, but at least he'd saved his life. But there wasn't a German left. The whole of the building was swept for Germans. They'd fled and escaped. There was not a single German, so he could walk freely out and decide, shall I join this person or that person? And so he said, I'll join Jacques, because he knows where to get cigars. And so I had a meeting with the two of them next day, and that was wonderful. So there are experiences of also of a humorous kind. In fact, it was not all sadness and tragedy. We laughed a lot during the occupation, in between also. Montfort was a man full of humor, and we laughed quite a lot. I mean, at times, as told you, it was boring. It was deathly boring. At times it was humorous. At times it was relevant, and things happened, and it was dangerous. But it was so many different things. But one was in it up to the hilt. Yeah. Now, I remember a little incident which happened at the end of the war, while I was in Copenhagen. There were three leading actors, two actors and an actress in the Royal Theatre, who were very clear in their hatred of the occupying power, but of course couldn't express it publicly, but had expressed it to their colleagues, and one of them, and one of the actors there, one of the ballet dancers, was an organized Nazi, Leif Ehrenberg, and his wife was also a member of the Nazi Party. And he was in contact with the Germans and with the Gestapo, and there was a threat that the Royal Theatre might be blown up if they didn't escape out of the country, that's to say to Sweden, the only way you could escape. But they wanted to be heroic and said, no, we're not going, we're staying, and it's our fate, and we will not fly, we will not escape. And Kjell Abel knew how silly that attitude was, because it was no good having the Royal Theatre blown to pieces, and it was better if they left. But they had said, we will not leave unless we have an order a direct personal order from a member of the Freedom Council. If we have that, we'll go, of course. So Caleb came to me and said, Elias, can you... he didn't say Elias because we didn't use our names. Can you arrange for a member of the Freedom Council? Now, Mons Faux was arrested. Bohoman was in hospital. And there was no one I could get except my old teacher who's professor of English, Professor Bodelson, who had replaced Mons Faux as representative of Free Denmark in the Freedom Council. So I told him about this, and he was ready to come to a private meeting with these three people from the Royal Theatre. I asked him if they knew him. No, they didn't know him, but I knew them because it's like knowing Laurence Olivier and John Gielgud and so on, but John Gielgud doesn't know everybody because everybody knows him. So he was prepared to come and meet them, and Caleb was there and I was there, and it was all very formal and clear-cut. He said, I've just come to give you a definite order to go to Sweden. It's important that you must obey this order. Yes, we will. And then he left, the representative of the Freedom Council, Bodelson, and I left, and Caleb was left behind with a man who's still, he's now 83, and he's an actor in the Royal Theatre, still active and very, very able. And he said to Caleb afterwards, of course, it was excellently done. It's only because I'm an actor myself and knows about disguises that I could see who it was. Otherwise, it would have worked perfectly and no one would suspect who it was. And Caleb, who knew that it was Professor Bodelson, who was in no disguise at all, but had a moustache and had glasses, ordinary, so was looking himself. And he said, who do you think? Oh, we shouldn't mention names, but of course it's obvious. And at last he got it out of him that it was Christmas Møller, who was in England. And there were rumors that he had now been parachuted into Denmark and joined the resistance, which he never did. And he had recognized him as the representative, and that influenced his decision very much to have this important person to give him the order. But that was one of the, just a little story from that time. I should also say that Kjell Abel, who was now underground, came to me one day and said that a famous Danish composer and a famous Danish songwriter had decided that the resistance movement needed a song of protest which should be become very popular and really be a signal for revolt. And so it was a very good tune and very good words. They had got somebody semi-professional to sing it. But it should be organized in a proper way so that it should be Free Denmark, which really took it on its wings and should send it to the BBC with a request that this should be used from now on as the signal tune from the Danish resistance movement. But we couldn't do that unless... So I arranged, and Mons Faux wasn't there, I arranged that we had a meeting of the whole committee, which was about, I think, 8 people at that time. And we had the singer to sing the song for us. And everybody was delighted that that's it, and decided that this should be recognized as the song, and with both the words, tune, and the words for the resistance movement. But in order to start in the right way, it should be a record should be made so that it could be, and there was a secret record radio to England, but of course it's very primitive. A record was made and sent by Germany to the BBC, to the Danish section there.
Via Sweden?
Via Sweden, yes. Of course, you couldn't send anything direct, unless by air. You could more wire things, but you couldn't send a parcel to England. So it was sent via Sweden, and somehow it vanished. It never reached the BBC. And we waited for it, and nothing happened. And then we decided to send Kjell Abel over to Sweden illegally, a secret mission to go to Stockholm and to have an orchestra there to have made a good record of it, have somebody to sing it, and it was then sent to England and to the BBC, and it became, within a very short time, a thing which everybody whistled in the street. So it had the right effect. It's called the Song of Freedom. And it really was psychologically the right time to do it. So this became a special added to it. It was very late in the occupation period, but it really, people got to know it. And there's another thing I must tell you also from the final period. This was after Mogens Fog had come out of the shell house and had taken shelter for the first night or two with the editor of Politiken. But this was not a place. He simply knocked the door and said, "Can I stay here tonight?" And of course they said yes. And he said, the editor of Politiken, who'd been very sort of subservient to the Germans, said, "Why did you come to me?" "Oh, simply because no German would ever suspect you of having anything to do with resistance." And that was quite correct. But the thing I was going to tell you was that wait a minute. The thing I want to tell you is that while I was responsible, with Fog being in the custody of Gestapo, Hohmann being ill in hospital, I was really responsible for Denmark. And we had a man who was a member of the local Copenhagen group, who was a rather daring character. He was right, but he took upon himself things which we would never have asked him to do. He established, for instance, contact with Gestapo officers privately in a restaurant and made it clear to them that he was had connections with the resistance, at least. And this was at a time when they were getting cold feet. And he came to me one day and said, there's a German Gestapo officer called Hermansen who has told me to show his goodwill that you can name 10 people, not in Germany, but 10 prisoners in a Danish camp who can be set free tomorrow. You can't do it with people in Germany, but just to show that we are willing to cooperate. So I went to Faux and we decided on a list of 10 names, and they were set free the next day. And that showed us that this man had really established a contact with the Gestapo, which we would never have asked him to do. And I mean, he was in a dangerous position. And the next thing was that he came. And that was in, that was in the spring of 45. In April, and now it was, now the Germans were really getting hot under the collar and realized that the time was up, or coming up now. And he came to tell me that, from the same Hermansen, that the German head of the military occupying forces in Denmark, General Lindemann, had sent an officer to Copenhagen whose duty was to cooperate with the resistance movement to discuss the conditions of a possible capitulation. And this was such a serious message, and I could, and from a man who had helped us with the 10 people previously, that we thought this must be taken seriously. Montfort was out of German custody, was in a private house with friends of mine where I'd got him established, and I told him the story. And he said, this is something we can't deal with without consulting the headquarters, Ike, and military forces in Britain. We must have orders. So a telegram must be sent by code to Britain about this, and we cannot begin to negotiate without having permission from Allied headquarters about it. So it was decided. After a while, reply came back, but took 2 days or so. Then the reply came back from Allied headquarters that they would not allow any member of the Freedom Council to negotiate with the German representative, but they should choose somebody else who was not a member of the Freedom Council. And they decided to choose me to negotiate, well, at least to meet this man who proved out